Hello, and welcome to Cult Picks Radio, coming to you from the past, beaming into the future, but you are hearing it in the present, which has now joined your past. I am, of course, your host, Django Nudodastrumus.
And I am the smut peddler who can see both your future and your past.
And you're going to be revealing a little bit about the future of Cult Picks releases and other shows that are coming before the summer break.
That's something we can actually predict for real. Yeah.
We can predict that with more accuracy than Chris will.
Definitely.
So tell us, oh great seeing master, what does the future hold for us in terms of the next episodes of Cult Picks Radio?
Yes, we are looking at a very interesting summer. I think we've already talked about that. We have all the slots filled until October, but in the upcoming weeks, we will have, actually starting very, very soon, a week with 11 films by Bob Chin, the maestro extraordinaire of the golden age of pornography in America in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yes, and there's some beautifully restored from 35mm HD copies. So vintage smut looking its best.
Definitely. And as we like to mix it up a lot, the week after will be our first out of two weeks with martial arts films, which is something we have been sorely lacking during our first 2 years, I would say. But thanks to our cooperation with our friends at Echelon, we have a ton of kung fu movies. So really excited about that. And the week after, starting on the 25th of June, we will have a week of 70s horror films. And we know our fans are always looking out for 70s and 80s horror. So we do believe that we will have some big fans for that.
Including a couple of really, really famous ones.
Yes.
Not to give it away, but
very famous ones. Indeed. Probably, I would argue, the most famous films we have had so far.
Yeah. Still cult films, but the
kind of mainstream-ish.
Yeah. They went mainstream afterwards. But
yeah.
Anyway, enough
and
teasing.
And then starting out on the 2nd of July, we will do our final week of 7 Zatoichi films, which are available in Scandinavia only for rights reasons. But that will conclude our Zatoichi season of 21 films. You heard it right.
Wow.
21 films with a blind swordsman slash masseur slash gambler.
Yeah.
Moving on in July, we will have a week of, I would say, how Sweden was perceived internationally. In terms of, using the word Sweden in a sort of seedy way, and also how Swedish actresses were exported to international productions, as they were also like a guarantee for the titulating stuff.
I think you called it Swedish broads abroad.
Exactly. Yes. And the week after that, as we really do mix things up, we are doing, it's from the 16th of July, a week of real bona fide science fiction classics. And that's how far we want to talk today, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. We've actually thought further and we have films for further, but that's enough of an appetite or teaser.
Yes, and can you predict, pray ask, what films we have been screening this week?
Yes, I can. In fact, we've had not quite a trilogy, but a threesome of Hungarian Easterns. And they are truly unique because although there were other countries other than America that were making horse operas, mostly they pretended to be in the US West. So whether it's Vinnetou or Spaghetti Westerns, they did, take place in some part of the American West. But the Hungarian Easterns look a lot like Westerns, but they take place on the plains of Magyar.
Yes. And I've listened to the music for some of them, and they have this clippity-cloppity horse rhythm to the songs. So they really went for the whole Western, you know, feel.
Yeah. I mean, apart from lack of Indians or Native Americans, obviously, they've got all the trappings of a Western. That, you know, it's horses, gunslingers, cattle ranchers, rustlers, desperados, you know, scenic long lensed shots of people riding towards the camera on a horseback against the setting sun. It's all there.
It's all there. I think the main difference is the size of the mustaches.
Yeah.
Because these are humongous mustaches.
Very Habsburg mustaches, but, you know, that's the only thing to be enjoyed more. And that will be one of the two topics in the next two episodes of Cultpix Radio before we have a break for the summer. The films will keep coming over the summer, but we will take a little bit of a summer breather. So the Hungarian Easterns is the topic of next week's Cultpix Radio. And after that, we will be talking all things Bob Chin. In other news, I don't know if we mentioned this in the last episode, but we were super thrilled to be mentioned as one of the top 10 best new streaming services by A Good Movie Watch, agoodmovietowatch.com.
Yeah.
And we were a very distinguished company there. HBO's Max, or just Max as it's called now, was one or the other one. And they had other ones, big ones like Peacock, Discovery Plus, and some we hadn't heard of, some we know, like Arrow Player. So, and we never paid for this. It wasn't written by a friend. This genuinely came as a bolt out of the blue, but a very pleasant and nice surprise kind of bolt.
We were in very good company there.
One of the other things that happened in the past week is we got a very nice letter from a fan in Australia asking if Cultpix is available down under. It is indeed in 195 countries. This fan from Australia got in touch with us and came up with some great suggestions. We always have wonderful, wonderful ideas from our dear listeners and fans. And it prompted us to spring into action, and immediately we created a subgenre for LGBTQ+ films.
Indeed.
We didn't realize just how much queer cinema we had on Cultpix already. I also have a mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. People wrote and asked to us about the newsletter, the Weekly Exploiter, which wasn't so much weekly as bi-weekly and then monthly. We're in the process of rejigging it. We could do a much better job. I could do a much better job with a newsletter, and it's a good and important way of keeping in touch with our followers and fans and members and keeping them updated. And I just think that we need to rethink it to make it a bit shorter, sharper, because people don't have infinite amount of time, and instead do more writing on the website itself, as, for example, a background about Ed Wood. So that's something I'm going to be working on over the summer as we forever tinker and retweet and reconsider how we do things better. I think it's time to move on to the main topic this episode, which is, of course, the career and films of Edward D. Wood Jr. And here to talk about it with us, I am super thrilled to be able to introduce Jim Nipfel. And I had the pleasure of getting to know him and reaching out to him after reading a great article that he wrote called Ed Wood, Not Actually the Worst Director in History, written for the Den of Geeks, where he makes a very strong case for the fact that we should stop calling Ed Wood the worst director in history, and makes a persuasive case in the article, and I'm sure shortly, about why Ed Wood's films have a unique energy and charm that should be appreciated. It's great to have Jim on Cultpix Radio.
God help us in the future.
So first of all, thank you for agreeing to do this. Jim, we'll let you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your background before we get on to Ed Wood.
So, my background. Well, I'm have been a journalist, novelist, memoirist for roughly the last 35 to 40 years. Spent most of my career in New York, writing for newspapers and magazines and what have you. I have about 15 books out, though only one of them has specifically to do with cinema. I became a movie geek very early on, about age 4 or 5, when my parents began taking me to see the movies. And also when I was a kid, there was a local station that every weekday, starting right after I got out of school, they would play or broadcast a sometimes shockingly uncut movie. And this was most of them genre films, and that's where my real film education took place. So, you know, they would show westerns, but a lot of science fiction, a lot of horror. That was my introduction to the whole Toho universe. So, what else? I'm blind. I do a lot of work with musical bands.
So I came across you when I was researching Ed Wood Jr. for our theme week, and you wrote an incredibly good, long, detailed, persuasive article for Den of Geek called Ed Wood, Not Actually the Worst Director in History. And I, before we get into talking about it, can you tell us a little bit about just how that article came about?
Since Ed Wood's rediscovery, maybe about 40 years ago now, an awful lot, you know, almost everything that can be said about Ed Wood has been said, and some of it is actually true. The discussion about Ed Wood has fallen essentially into two camps. You have kind of smug, smirking, you know, ironic hipsters who have heard the name and may have seen one film, maybe seen, you know, maybe saw Plan 9, maybe not all of it, and some of Glenn or Glenda. And, you know, the name has simply become a trigger, right? When you see Ed Wood's name, he's become synonymous with, you know, incompetent filmmaking. And that can be traced back to 1980, when a film critic by the name of Michael Medved, who would later become a consumer reporter on television and then a wild-eyed right-wing kook, put out a book called The Golden Turkey Awards, in which, for the first time, Ed Wood was declared the worst director who's ever lived, and Plan 9, the worst film ever made. Now, the interesting thing is that a year before that, Medved had put out a book called The 50 Worst Films Ever Made, in which Ed Wood, and none of his, Ed Wood is never mentioned in neither are any of his films. So it was specifically in that book, which was a very popular book at the time, that everybody suddenly latched on to Ed Wood. And again, it just became this, it became a code word for bad filmmaking. So you have the people who kind of react to that, and don't know further. Then there's the minority opinion of, which I hold, that sees Ed Wood as an American eccentric, as who had this very idiosyncratic vision, who was a self-conscious outsider artist, and who had the enthusiasm and the energy and the simple drive to take these ideas and get them up on film, which is no small task. as you know. I mean, he had to scramble for money and actors and build sets and everything else. So, and there is a good deal to be admired about that. And when you actually go back and look at the films, you know, without this preconceived notion, they aren't that bad. Some of them are, well, confusing. But worst films ever made, absolutely not. I think far worse films are being made today, and they're being made with $70 million budgets, you know, and all-star cast.
But it's a very good point, I think, a strong one, and the fact that he, far from being the worst one, and there are plenty of B and C movie directors who have done, I agree with you, much worse films, that he fits more into the eccentric or very unique voice camp of directors. So he's no different in that regard from John Waters, for example. Right. Nobody would call him bad. His films might be, you know, not in everybody's taste.
Exactly. And, you know, and there are a number of, you know, them out there. Well, here's a little test I like to use. If you look at a couple of, scenes from an Ed Wood film, here's some of the dialogue. He had a recognizable style. Right, you can look at these films, and you know, after just a couple minutes, you'll think this is an Ed Wood film, and the same with John Waters, say W. E. Wilder, and you can't say that about everybody else's films. He had, you know, he had a style. He had, you know, a bit of va va voom. You know, trying to think of directors who are still working today. That you can look at something and say, well, you know, that's a, you know, film by so-and-so after just a couple minutes. Mm. So another test I like to use is you could take Ed Wood's name, show something like, you know, Un Chien Andalou, take Buñuel's name off of it, slap Ed Wood's name on it, and see how people react.
Very good point.
And also I would say that his art is very, he's a very consistent artist in terms of both the films he directed and the ones that he only wrote the screenplay for. They're immediately recognizable as Ed Wood screenplays.
Yeah. And that's another thing. That's why, you know, when you see some of the later films, you know, like Orgy of the Dead, which was directed by,
Kostolov.
Thank you. Yes. You know, it looks and feels like an Ed Wood film.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose the myth, the legend has also been built up by Tim Burton's lovingly made and a beautiful Ed Wood film with a great, I believe, Oscar winning screenplay. But again, it just homes in on the Bela Lugosi friendship and a couple of his films, primarily Plan 9, obviously, and Glenn and Glenda, but leaving out so much more about his life, his career, his right. achievements. And and again, in that way, as much as, you know, it is done with the greatest of affection, it does him a disservice in terms of narrowing our scope and vision of him.
Right. It was, I mean, it's a beautiful film. I love that film. It's very much a whitewash, and it's maybe understandably coming from Tim Burton's perspective, it holds up the mythology that surrounds Ed Wood. I mean, personally, Wood was kind of a mess, you know. He was... He was an alcoholic. He wasn't good with money. You know, he was a very troubled man. We don't see that coming out. We see him as this kind of very enthusiastic, charming fellow. Mm. But still, love the film, and I'm very happy it was made.
Yes. Now we have, in fact, 20 films, TV episodes, short films in the Cult Picks theme week that in some way have a tie to Ed Wood, whether it is one of the directed ones or based on a book by him or even a, allegedly a screenplay by him, like Hot Ice, 1977.
Right.
But we won't be able to do all of them, but I would like to pick your brains and get your opinions on a few of them. And I think it would be wonderful if we could start off with Glenn or Glenda, because I don't want to go straight for the cherry with Plan 9, but Glenn and Glenda is obviously the other famous one. And again, solidifies some of the myths around him about him directing films in women's clothes.
Right.
Again, not really, not strictly true.
Right. Just, I mean, only on that film and only when he was directing his own scenes, when he was playing Glenda. So yeah, but actually a lot of the things about Ed Wood's story depend entirely upon who's telling it. There are a lot of contradictory stories out there from people, you know, who had worked with him. But Glenn or Glenda is a fascinating film. Again, one in which I think if you were to, you know, reverse what I was saying earlier and slap, say, Salvador Dali's name on it, or Buñuel, people look at it very differently. But it's, well, the story is, of course, that shortly after Christine Jorgensen had the sex change operation, it was international news, the producer, you know, low-budget producer, wanted to make the film version but couldn't get the rights. So decided just to make a more generic sex change movie, and Wood came to him and said, well, that he was the one to make it because he was a transvestite and so understood the mindset. And only after he brought in, you know, Bela Lugosi to star in it, did he get the deal. And so he wrote a very autobiographical script about his hesitation to, or his struggle really, to let his girlfriend at the time, Dolores Fuller, know that he was a transvestite. And but then it was also almost as if every other thought he ever had, he tried to cram into this movie. So it's like one long non sequitur. From scene to scene, but fascinating. And you just can't stop watching, wondering where he's going to go next. The kind of imagination that is involved, even in something like that, is pretty remarkable. And then you have Lugosi sitting in a hotel room, making these proclamations and we don't know why or what they mean exactly. He pulls the strings, as he says repeatedly.
Beware, beware, beware of the big green dragon that sits on your doorstep. He eats little boys, Bobby Duck tails, big fat snails. Beware. Take care. Beware.
It's really a wonderful and oddly charming film. But since it obviously wasn't the film that the producer wanted, for the last 10 minutes, we do get kind of an almost documentary style account of a man who wants to, you know, literally get a sex change operation. Film actually really works as a plea for understanding and a plea for kindness for cross-dressers. And, you know, to expand on that, you know, does people of other, you know, sexual persuasions, that was very daring for the time. And I'm trying to think, because other than that, I mean, cross-dressing was always used for comic effect. You know, some like it hot or melted in Burl. So,
Before we get on to Jailbait, I also wanted to bring up if we're referencing him in a kind of artistic perspective, what was unique, I suppose, about Ed Wood is also is that he built this. He had an ensemble of regular actors, Bela Lugosi being the most famous one, but it was almost like Andy Warhol's factory in a proto stage in terms of the people he picked up along the way, the outcasts, the misfits. I didn't know that Lyle Talbot was a Warner Brother contract player until he dared to found the Screen Actors Guild, and then it was all
right
downhill for him.
That was true. He was in a lot of Warner Brothers films, and then some PRC and other Poverty Row films, and then he ended up with Ed Wood. There were a few other than helping to form Screen Actors Guild was a biggie. There were a few other scandals, but he got work. A lot of his regular players who moved from film to film, like Paul Marco and Duke Moore, they never did anything else. They never did anything before or after their Ed Wood films. Dolores Fuller, after she and Ed Wood broke up, she had a very good career writing songs for Elvis Presley movies. She did okay for herself. And these days, or she was very, very bitter about the way she was treated in the, say, Ed Wood literature and also in the film.
Yep.
So, Ed Wood.
In terms of collaborators, and moving on to Jailbait, you make the point that Alex Gordon is often left out of the Ed Wood story, but he did play a big, big role, really, in shaping Ed Wood's career in films, at least initially.
Right. He was a producer and screenwriter who came over from England in the early 50s, and he and Wood struck a friendship. And they began to collaborate on a number of things, including Jailbait, Violent Years, and Bride of the Monster. And he gave some coherence, to the scripts. You know, so these were real stories. If they had continued working, they split up after Bride of the Monster, when Gordon went and became one of the earlier producers at American International, which had just been formed. If they had stuck together, it's conceivable that Ed Wood would be forgotten today, or remembered only as, say, a third-tier director. Kind of like W. E. Wilder, who was a hero of mine. He was able to, work on these three films, and they even started getting some budgets. I think Bride of the Monster, they had $70,000 to work with there, I believe, at the end. So he certainly helped shape what an Ed Wood film was, and very valuable for that. But yeah, he's mostly been left out because I think people prefer to think of someone like Ed Wood as as an auteur. It was just his story, but he had a number of collaborators along the way.
And Ed Wood, like so many genre film or exploitation film directors had the good habit of just grabbing headlines or topical stories, whether it's sex change or juvenile delinquency, that was making waves at the right. time. And that really informed this film. That's it's not a great story, but it's interestingly handled by him.
Right. And also, I mean, working with the title Jailbait, which they knew was a provocative title, and in the end they had to drop in an extra line that we hear Dolores Fuller read off screen, saying that gun is jailbait, which is the only time that's mentioned in the film. So not the usual connotation.
How about my gun?
I think we'll hold on to that for a little while.
You have no right to keep my property.
We've got all the rights right now. Now go on, get out of here before I have you put back in the cell.
Don, there's been enough trouble. Let's go home.
And then he followed that up with another juvenile delinquent film, The Violent Years, which he did not direct, but wrote. Later on, I mean, you have the trilogy. There isn't, they pretty much stand alone. But then later films like Sinister Urge, goes back to the underworld of pornography, which again, 1960 was a very shocking move on his part.
I'd forgotten as well that it was Herbert Rowland's last and final film, that he was actually dying of lung cancer as they were shooting.
Yeah, died the night he finished his final scene.
Which is a super pro, I have to say, in acting, like Bela Lugosi, who didn't make it all the way through, died well before Plan 9, but yes, he didn't need a replacement.
Yeah. Lugosi was actually in very, very bad shape when he made Bride of the Monster, but it was. But he still gives a wonderful, energetic performance.
Moving on now to Bride of the Monster. Again, Tim Burton got it half right, didn't he, in the Ed Wood film, for example. Mm-hmm. The cinematographer really was colorblind, wasn't he?
Yes, he was colorblind, but when you're making a black and white film, that isn't,
it's not a handicap,
impediment. there are a lot of contradictory stories there. And in the end, I think ultimately the myth is much more important, but, the octopus, it's argued that the octopus was broken, and that's why Lugosi had to, pretend to fight with it at the end of the film, actually grabbing the tentacles and pulling them over himself. Not exactly true. The octopus half worked, and you can see that in earlier scenes. And also, Lugosi did not do his own stunts, so he was not in that scene. And then there's the story of Loretta King. Originally, again, Dolores Fuller was supposed to have the lead. Ed Wood, and this is another story whose changes depending on who's doing the telling. But basic story is that Ed Wood believed for some reason that she had a lot of money, that she was willing to invest in the film. And so he offered her the lead. And bumped Dolores to, very minor role, where I think she has just two or three lines. She was very angry about that. But Loretta King was no actress. But still, a wonderful story. And Lugosi is great.
Home. I have no home, hunted,
beast. Living like an animal. The jungle is my home. That I will show the world that I can be its master. I will perfect my own race of people. A race of atomic supermen which will conquer the world.
Lugosi, who gets the great monologue about his backstory.
It's a thing of wonder that Lugosi, you know, co-wrote, and you have to wonder how much of that is autobiographical. Lugosi as well. It's it's beautiful. It's heartbreaking.
He drew on a lot of experience there, definitely, exile and outcast and somebody who struggled with many, many challenges, shall we say.
Yeah. So, and after his beginning his career in Hungary as a noted stage actor who played all sorts of roles.
Oh, Shakespearean even. Yeah.
Exactly. And then to come back here and or come over to the States and be pigeonholed. Not only pigeonholed, but the scripts got smaller and smaller and smaller. And then he ended up on Poverty Row, and then he ended up in Ed Wood films.
Chronologically, we've now come up to the crowning achievement, if not defining film of Edward Wood Jr.'s career, Plan 9 from Outer Space. What is there to say about Plan 9 that hasn't been said, or that's worth repeating, or that's takes people away from the kind of the myth and the preconception about it?
Well, I think the first thing is that what people seem to forget is that there is a real story there. There is a plot. How it was realized on the screen, maybe another matter, but it was certainly an interesting and imaginative story, that aliens had been trying to contact the governments of the world to try and get them to stop development of the solenite bomb that would actually ignite light particles and destroy the entire universe. But since the government won't listen, they decide that the way to make the government listen is to reanimate the dead and send a zombie army on Washington, which would then force the government to admit that there were aliens, which is he worked with a logic all of his own, but you come to accept it. I mean, something I have long felt is that if you approach a film like this, or say a Godzilla film, you just need to suspend disbelief and just accept what's in front of you. And people are not often willing to do that. Well, we did get, the introduction of Criswell there, and Tor Johnson's back, a number of the same characters. But what more is there to say about
I think it's worth reiterating what you said earlier, which is it's not a bad film. It has its own very unique aesthetic. And if somebody like, a recognized art house director or, Salvador Dali had put their name on it, it would be viewed very, very differently. People would come to appreciate a lot of things about it. The cast is incredible. Forget the swapping out of Bela Lugosi, but just, from a pure visual perspective, it is such a rich film. And yes, the sets aren't, high budget, but they work in the context of the film. And when you look at other films from that era, I could argue a lot worse. Films that I personally love, like Catwoman off the Moon, but a dreadful film when it comes to the sets, the acting, the looks, everything. It's watchable despite itself.
They create, films like that. They create their own universe.
Yes.
They are aesthetic holes. In that sense.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about grave robbers from outer space?
Now, Plan 9 didn't actually, was made and then wasn't released. And it actually, the sequel to the film came out before Plan 9 itself.
Right.
Messing up the chronology, I suppose, Franny.
Yeah, and because it's a weird thing. It doesn't quite hold together, but somehow, those three films, Bride of the Monster, Plan 9, and Night of the Ghouls, were somehow supposed to be connected.
Mm-hmm.
So Night of the Ghouls came out first, and there are scenes in there when Kenneth Kopp makes references to plot elements in both Bride of the Monster and Plan 9, which of course hadn't come out yet. So
we should be talking really about the Ed Wood cinematic universe. He beat Marvel and DC to it with these cross parallel plots and characters and actors that pop up in all.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Night of the Ghouls is of the three the least remembered. Because it's kind of slow. The plot is simpler than the other two.
Now I tell you a tale of the Threshold people. So astounding that some of you may faint.
Where do I report a stolen car?
Come in here.
Your call got me just as I was getting out of the shower.
That clapper on the door was meant for announcing visitors. Through my powers of the supernatural, I, and I alone, can bring him to this room tonight. What do you want?
Oh, I'm frightened, Carl.
Of what?
Let everyone stay where they are. You're all under arrest.
There's my hat!
Keep your voice down, will you?
Well, at least we know where Dr. Acula is.
And you may join us soon.
Any other film whose narration was that entertaining?
Yes, and also with Lugosi out of the picture, it's almost Criswell taking over that kind of role of the voice of God, the
right
all-seeing eye.
So yeah, I'm especially fond of him in in Orgy of the Dead. So it's another wonderful character that we likely would know very little about or hear very little about these days, even though he was a very popular TV personality back then, you know, in the 50s, that had it not been for the Edward pictures.
So why is Night of the Ghouls not as much remembered as Plan 9 and Glen or Glendone? It's not a bad film. You know, it's just...
it's not a bad film. That may be its downfall, right? Is that there's not enough there for people to point and snicker at. You know, it's just as far as filmmaking goes, I think Wood by that time was getting a better handle on you know, pacing and coherence and how to set up a shot.
After that, or taking the point that Ed Wood was getting more accomplished as a filmmaker, at least knew his craft better, having done a few and quite a few by this. So it kind of came together in The Sinister Urge, which was quite different in terms of not having the usual assortment of undead, aliens, ghouls, right, monsters, ghosts, but being more of a straightforward crime story.
Right. So going back to those early years, you know, the violent years in Jailbait, but a little, you know, much rougher in The Sinister Urge, which is a film I like an awful lot. But again, 1960, when it was made, he's still pushing the boundaries of what can be allowed. You know, the code was still in effect. Hollywood code was still in effect. So, and he's, you know, making a film pretty bluntly about a pornography ring and a serial killer who is hired by, you know, a psychopath who was hired by the head of this porn ring to kind of keep all the girls who work for her in line. And when they don't, you know, when they try to leave, then she sticks the psychopath on him because he's driven into a murderous frenzy whenever he sees porn.
Look, I want action on this thing, and I want it quick. I've got my whole department working around the clock. Well, you'll have more help to call on. I announced in the early papers I'm making more men available to you. Now, Matt, this smut picture racket has got to be stopped. And the murders caused directly by this filth has to be stopped.
When I say let's see those legs, honey, I mean just that. Let's see those legs from your toes right up to your hat.
Now, in terms of the film being a quasi-roughy, it wasn't obviously the only kind of nasty, but slightly brutish B-film of its time. But it did then set up, and there is a lineage, isn't there, from this particular film of Ed Wood's and to the later films of Lee Frost and David F. Friedman and Byron Mabe, things like The Defilers and so on, that tap into that same kind of vein.
Right. And whether, you know, whether that can be traced directly back to Wood, I don't think so. I think there was just a lot going on. It was a change in the aesthetic, a change in the mindset.
Pushing up against the codes.
Exactly. Especially if you're working independently.
Now, it's arguably Ed Wood's last film in terms of being uniquely his, but he did make three more films in the kind of two decades after that, before his early death. And we've touched upon Orgy of the Dead, which, as well as being, you know, beautifully color, is very wacky and zany, and again comes back to the point you made about being almost art house in its kind of the deranged universe that it creates for itself.
Right. Again, it's kind of mind numbing. My reaction when I remember first seeing the film was the first three or four strippers. You know, that was great. That was a lot of fun. When you get to like the 15th, the 20th, it's a little mind-numbing, but again, fascinating because it does work like an art film. If you know, you take his whole oeuvre as a whole, there is a consistency there. You know, as with any filmmaker with style. The quality may go up and down from picture to picture, but there is a vision there that he carries through.
But he stopped effectively being a director, and his contributions from the later years that we have on Cult Picks are things that he may or may not have written the screenplay to, right, such as 1 Million ACDC or Hot Ice.
Right.
But he did keep active. I mean, he never quite gave up, even though he, as you said, spent more time just drinking, wearing women's clothes, and sort of not directing.
Yeah, but you know, but he wrote roughly that last decade. I mean, he wrote 18 scripts, something like that. And he was also writing a number of, you know, pulp novels.
Yes.
You know, a lot of them pornographic in nature, but those were the scripts he was working on at the time too. As he and Stevens edged more and more into the sort of the murky world between soft and hardcore.
He was forgotten, rediscovered, slandered, if you will, with this epitaph of worst director, worst film ever. Sure. But really having the last laugh, because here we are talking about him, having a retrospective of his films. That still matter to people out there.
Absolutely. If you think back, I mean, Plan 9 would turn 65 this year. And I think it would be Edward's 99th birthday this year. But take pretty much any film made, say, over the last 20 years and look ahead. So 65 years from now, are people still going to be talking about Everything Everywhere All at Once or Silver Linings Playbook or whatever happens to be, the film du jour, but they're still going to be watching Ed Wood and talking about Ed Wood because, you know, he has, he's been so mythologized and so, you know, digested by the culture that he's part of it now. He's an inescapable part of it.
It was as Criswell predicted, you know, Ed Wood was destined to live in the future.
Right.
Long may he continue to live.
Absolutely.
Well, Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, and thank you so much for coming on to Cult Picks Radio, for sharing your deep, deep insight, and above all, the love and affection for Ed Wood Jr. and his films.
And thank you again for asking me to be on. I've had a wonderful time.
And I definitely hope we have you again. So, Smut Peddler, are you convinced that we should stop calling Ed Wood the worst director in history?
I have been for some time, actually. I think Jim really argues a strong case. And I think it's basically, you know, prejudice and laziness that keeps people talking about him that way. Yeah. He's obviously a unique voice in terms of his yes. artistry, whether you like it or not, but not the worst one, definitely not.
No. And having gone back and looked through some of his films as we were researching this and looking for clips, I did appreciate that. He does have a very unique aesthetic, and what he achieved with very, very low means and the kind of the whole ensemble of actors, everything does deserve more respect. And hopefully this will be a little bit part in the process of rebuilding Ed Wood's reputation as, you know, not a trash auteur, but just a generally auteur and artist in his own right.
Yeah, and I think him, and as well as others of his contemporaries and those who came after, have been reappraised, like Herschel Gordon Lewis, like Doris Wishman, yes. like yes. Joe Sarno. I mean, it's really it's taken time and also rediscovery of a lot of films that were thought to be lost that have now been released.
And we will continue with that mission here on Cult Picks of dragging them out to the gutter and putting them on the small pedestal that they deserve to yes. stand on. Now, I know that you've been doing a lot of musical research in and around Ed Wood as well, and you've come up with quite an extraordinary Spotify playlist, which we will link to, as always, in the line notes. By the way, I should say, I keep forgetting to do this every time. If you're listening to this podcast, please, please, please rate it, review it, tell us what you like about it, but it helps other people find it if you put in a good word for us. So that was a short little public service announcement. Definitely. Back to the Spotify playlist of Ed Wood films.
Yeah,
what can
I mean,
tell us about
it,
Smart Peddler?
It was astounding how inspirational he has been for musicians. I mean, in terms of the width, the breadth of genres, of artists that have songs named after Ed Wood films, named after himself, of course, Vampyra. I was quite astonished at the number. I think it's the list is it's at least 30-35 songs, and they are all very directly related to Wood.
Yes. To play us out, I will let you pick one of your favorite songs from the Spotify list, and just want to thank again our wonderful guest Jim Nipple. I hope that we will have him back on very, very soon, because I don't just love his knowledge, I love his voice, I love everything that he brings to the proverbial table.
Absolutely.
But for now, that's all from me, Django Nudo.
And for me, the Smut Peddler.
I was watching TV when the sun was setting, a trick shoot with Kenny Duncan. Say Glenda, Glenda, the crossroad he went, you're doing the adventures of the Doosan Kid. Strap on my boots, outside a jail waits waiting, a bride of the monster she's been. You face the final curtain, the night the banshee cried.
Like Edward.